House Speaker Paul Ryan shocked the political world last week when he announced he would retire in 2019 after the midterm elections. Of course, in most years, that would be huge news that would dominate the political news cycle. 2018 shaping up to be a little different, though, and it quickly faded from the headlines, but it's still a big story here in the Valley, of course, because of the man who is likely to be Ryan's successor. Joining us now to talk about that and some other local and regional political issues, we have Fresno State political science professor Thomas Holyoke. Tom, welcome.
Good morning, Joe.
So Kevin McCarthy endorsed last week on the Sunday morning programs by Paul Ryan as his preferred choice to be the next Speaker of the House. This is a little bit of deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra would say. Back in 2015, I recall having a very similar conversation with you. How is McCarthy different this time?
That's right. Last time, when John Boehner was essentially forced out of the Speaker's chair, and the Republicans were scrambling a bit to figure out who would actually take over because there was no clear successor. At what point, Kevin McCarthy, who's already in the leadership as the whip, came forward, and but then accidentally mentioned on air that maybe the investigations into Hillary Clinton and her email were politically motivated. And after that, his stock with the Republican caucus went down a little bit, and they had to turn to Paul Ryan to take on the speakership.
And of course, Ryan was something of a reluctant speaker at that time, and political winds have continued to change since then. McCarthy, though, even back then in 2015, had some critics on his right from the Freedom Caucus members of his own party. Has his stance with the most staunchly conservative members of his party, has that changed at all in the last 2 years with the Trump administration now in office? A lot of them are very critical of the omnibus bill that the president signed and McCarthy helped get through.
No, I actually do not think that McCarthy has improved relations with the Freedom Caucus a whole bunch yet. And that's being reflected in a couple of ways. One, the current majority whip, Steve Scalise, has more or less said he'll support McCarthy this time around. It seems to be a little on the reluctant side and could emerge, I think, is still a challenge. More importantly, the leader of the Freedom Caucus, Congressman Jordan, has said that he is exploring a run for the speakership. It's unlikely he would win, but he could pull enough votes away from McCarthy to deny McCarthy the speakership and actually throw the entire Republican leadership into chaos. In other words, the Freedom Caucus is basically telling McCarthy, we've got some demands that you're going to have to meet if you want to be the Speaker of the House. So McCarthy has a lot of work ahead of him in trying to really unify the caucus behind his candidacy for the speakership.
McCarthy is a great fundraiser, by all accounts, amongst members of his caucus. He works the room really well. He knows all these details about everyone, and he uses that to his advantage in negotiations. He was a protege, or he helped understudy Kevin Spacey for his famous role, and that quote that McCarthy provided him, vote your conscience, vote your district. This don't surprise me. The role of being a whip or a majority leader, does that automatically transfer in skills to being a good House Speaker or an effective Speaker of the House? Is there a different skill set there, a lot more on camera?
There are some differences there. I mean, when you are whip and majority leader, you are essentially responsible for organizing the majority caucus. And to a large extent, that's a behind-the-scenes role. The speaker has two interesting roles which are not entirely consistent with each other. One is to be the public face of the Republican Party or the majority party in the House, but the speaker is also responsible for the well-being of the entire House of Representatives. And sometimes that works a bit against being leader of the majority party. And Paul Ryan has struggled a little bit with that while trying to wear both hats simultaneously. Indeed, that's part of what probably brought down John Boehner, because Boehner knew he needed to get some things done for the best interests of the country, and that set parts of his caucus against him and tore him to pieces and brought him down. So McCarthy's going to have to find a way to really walk both those planks simultaneously, and that's a hard thing to do. And he has to be the public face of the House and of his party.
And that means communicating on television and other new media that's out there now. McCarthy has not really ever faced a serious political challenger in his district. Very popular in his district in Bakersfield. Certainly many people don't like him. But overall, you look at the vote totals, and it's been resounding wins all across the board. Is it maybe a concern potentially that he hasn't been tested in that type of a tough contest? And does that reflect in any way in the heat of Washington politics?
That could be a concern for some House Republicans. McCarthy's district is a safe district, safe for Republicans. And so unlike Paul Ryan, remember Paul Ryan had to go through the entire experience of being Mitt Romney's running mate. And so Paul Ryan got very tested on the national stage before becoming speaker. And yeah, Kevin McCarthy has never had to go through anything like that. So there may be some doubts in the Republican caucus whether McCarthy is truly experienced enough, really has the thick skin or steel spine necessary to lead the Republican caucus through what is a very, very difficult time. After all, the Republicans are fighting to hold on to their majority in the House of Representatives.
And speaking of the House seats that are up for contest this year, one of them locally that's drawing the most attention is that currently held by Tulare Republican Devin Nunes. There's been a lot of national attention, of course, on Nunes due to his role in the House Intelligence Committee and as a supporter of the president and with the Russia investigation in the House. But his challenger, one of his most high-profile challengers, because there are many, but Andrew Jans has brought in a lot of money recently. At one point, does that start to really make a difference? Nunes has such a sizable war chest, over $4 million last I checked.
Yeah, Congressman Nunes is probably not quaking in his shoes yet, but the challenge from Andrew Jans is one that he would need to take seriously. This is probably the biggest, most serious challenge that Congressman Nunes has ever had to face since initially being elected to the House of Representatives. Andrew Jans has been able to raise a lot more money than people have in the past, and a lot of that is because Devin Nunes has taken on this very high profile nationwide and one that's received a lot of attention and a lot of negative attention, which has been able to make it easier for Andrew Jans to raise significant amounts of money, as well as level some charges at Devin Nunes that Nunes is so interested in having a national profile that he's neglecting his district.
Certainly one that we're watching. In fact, the Jans campaign already starting to put out some contributions to other Democrats in other races, a sign of the type of money they have coming in right now. If you're the Nunes campaign looking at his district, which encompasses much of Tulare County and then all the way up into the Clovis area and a portion of North Fresno, what are sort of the areas that are most contentious here, looking at the individual parts of the district? What's going to decide this?
Well, Jan seems to be concentrating a lot of his efforts right now sort of in the Clovis area.
Why is that?
Well, I think it's more his natural base, actually.
But Clovis has a reputation of being pretty conservative. And I've been struck by the same thing. All of his messaging seems to be focused on Clovis.
I think Jan's is feeling that Devin Nunes probably has not made much of an effort to engage voters in Clovis, that there's been all the accusations made that, Devin Nunes is not holding town hall meetings, that, Devin Nunes's office in Clovis is never open, that Devin Nunes has effectively no presence in Clovis, and even making the argument that Devin Nunes has abandoned voters in Clovis. So I think Jans feels that is the best opportunity for him to make some inroads against Devin Nunes.
But that overall district still on the relatively safe side at this point, and nothing significantly has changed in that level?
I don't think so. I mean, the
pull out our crystal ball here.
the district still leans Republican. It went for Donald Trump pretty heavily. said a moment ago, I don't think Devin Nunes is quaking in his shoes quite yet.
Speaking of quaking in his shoes, what about David Valadao, TJ Cox, a late entrant into that race after Emilio Huerta pulled out? Huerta lost resoundingly to Valadao, who is so strong in Kings County and his home base there, but also does well and surprisingly well, according to some, in Kern County. Does Cox really have any sort of chance there, especially given his lack of name ID in the South Valley?
David Valadao, this interesting phenomenon, a Republican who continuously wins in a Democratic-heavy district. I do not believe at this time that T.J. Cox is a formidable challenger. I actually think Emilio Huerta might have been able to do a bit better. Now, having said that, Valadao is also in a bit of an odd position right now, given the new farm bill that's being worked on in the House of Representatives. On the one hand, farmers in Valadao's district would really probably like to see this farm bill go through, but the farm bill is also making some changes to the SNAP program. It's a program that provides a lot of nutritional assistance to a lot of low-income people, and according to a report I heard this morning, there's about nearly 500,000 people in Valadao's district who could be potentially affected by changes to the SNAP program. Specifically, that the way the farm bill is shaping up, Republicans want to put a large number of work requirements in order to qualify for the SNAP program, and that could adversely affect a lot of Valadao's constituents. So Valadao needs to be a little careful on that, and that's something that Democrats could exploit. But again, you know, Valadao has shown many times that he is able to effectively and handily beat back any kind of challengers that the Democrats throw at him. I mean, Amanda Renteria a couple of years ago was supposed to be this incredible challenger, that the dream candidate of the Democrats, and she was crushed by Valadao.
Be very interesting to see how that shapes up. Moving a little more locally now, looking at something that's happening. In fact, we mentioned Emilio Huerta. The story is potentially that Huerta has his sights on a seat on the County Board of Supervisors because redistricting has taken place. MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, sued county supervisors there over a district line, saying they intentionally disenfranchised Latinos. They lost that legal battle in federal court in Fresno, and new lines have been drawn, creating a second Latino-majority district there and setting up a November election fight. Now, the Dolores Huerta Foundation has issued a similar legal threat to Tulare County, telling them the same thing, that lines that have been drawn intentionally disenfranchise Latino. And there's no current members of the Tulare County Board of Supervisors that are Latino, despite the fact that 64% of Tulare County is Latino. How significant are these things viewed in context? Plus, there's also an issue with the Kern High School District that's similar. But is this a signal of something significant happening locally?
We've been seeing this happen the last decade or so in a variety of situations here in the Valley. For Board of Education seats, city council seats, and now county supervisor seats, that the accusations are being made that there's been some gerrymandering in these districts to disenfranchise Latinos, when in fact Latinos, given their geographical concentration, ought to actually have their own districts. And that accusation seems to have some merit, given that there's been some court rulings in support of creating Latino-majority districts and breaking up districts that were cutting through Latino communities. So this has started to reshape the political structure of the Valley and will result in more Latinos being elected to a variety of offices, Board of Education, City Council, County Supervisor, which in the long run means that we'll probably see more Latinos moving into higher offices. They get themselves started on the lower political rungs.
Is Fresno County at the same risk for such legal action as Kern and Tulare, or is it a little different here?
You know, I'm not sure that Fresno County is quite so much at risk. I haven't had a chance to do any kind of a detailed analysis of the way the supervisor districts are drawn, but I don't get the feeling that they really break up Latino communities to quite the same extent. And, you know, we've had, Latino representatives on the Board of Supervisors before with, Henry Perea. So I'm not sure Fresno County has quite the same problem. But having said that, I think every Board of Supervisors at this point and every city council and every school district needs to take a close look at how their districts are drawn, because they could draw challenges in the future.
We've got a couple minutes left before we go, and I want to turn to Fresno city politics right now. Two competing proposals, one that's out publicly and one that's sort of in the open discussion but not formally announced stage, for competing sales tax increases to fund different things. One that would fund parks and arts, that's being advanced by the Central Valley Community Foundation and a number of groups under that umbrella, led by former Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen. And then another proposed sales tax increase that would be funding public safety. Mayor Lee Brand has signaled that he would likely support such a sales tax, and others are lining up there as well. How does this complicate the 2018 election season here, especially given two competing taxes? I guess there's four potential outcomes there, looking at it, and candidates have to take a position here.
Sure, and actually a little bit of disclosure here. I am on the board of directors of the San Joaquin River Parkway and Conservation Trust, which is endorsing the parks bond. This complicates things in a number of ways. These bonds need... Well, these proposals essentially need two-thirds support, and that's a pretty high threshold. And voters are never really in the mood to raise taxes. So with two competing proposals out there, that really makes it pretty difficult that either one would pass. They could both harm each other. Now, one of the other interesting things is that anybody running for city council right now is going to probably have to take a position on these things. And that could complicate some of the races, because if voters are getting a little iffy about the question of raising taxes, that might push city council candidates to oppose both measures, and that could really reduce the chances that either measure would succeed.
Also, is it interesting, the city just passed this new Parks Master Plan in January. It identifies a need for a lot more funding tens of millions in deferred maintenance. And it says new revenue sources are needed. The existing general fund simply can't devote that type of attention to parks. Does that put existing city leadership, even if they aren't up for re-election this year, does that put them in a little bit of a bind?
Well, it certainly should. I mean, it's well known that Fresno has a very serious green space problem. We need more parks badly. We need to do a better job maintaining the parks that we have. The city keeps saying it's strapped from cash and more revenue is needed. This parks bond is certainly a way to do it. And the city should feel under pressure to improve and expand its park system. And this is a good opportunity to do so.
We'll see how it plays with voters in November and see if it gets on the ballot. Signatures are being gathered right now for that as we speak. Again, Fresno State Professor Thomas Holyoke joining us for our politics talk today. Tom, great as always.
Always fun, Joe. Thank you.